Good evening, everyone. It is Sunday, April 29, 2007. I'm the Uncle.
And I am Charlie. Thank you, everybody, for joining us tonight. So, how you doing, Uncle?
I'm doing, pretty good. Can't complain. How about you?
Oh, doing fantastic. There was lots of fun in the sun out there working like a day laborer on my property. That's always a good way to spend a Sunday. You gotta love
that's
that.
That's excellent.
Yeah, and you know, when the environment and the days and the longer afternoons and evenings turn to this sort of weather, people start getting that itch to do spring cleaning. And I know that when that spring cleaning itch starts, you know, it possesses people like a fever. And they just gotta get rid of their most cherished possessions. And it's what I like to call, yard sale days. And we've really just begun yard sale days around here and middle of the hinterlands where I live. And the funny thing about living in the hinterlands is usually people don't have a whole lot of fancy stuff. But there is a fancy neighborhood, and there was a yard sale in one of the fancy neighborhoods this weekend. And Uncle, interestingly, Uncle, I was browsing Craigslist like I am wont to do, and was searching for the keyword Sega, which is always fun to do. And the only thing that came, actually, a couple things came back. There are a couple people selling some Sega equipment in town that I'm still following up with. And there was one garage sale that actually said like video game, Sega equipment, something. So
really?
Yeah, so you can imagine I was interested, and I actually dragged my butt out of bed at 8 a.m. Saturday morning. I drove into town, and I was a few minutes late, so I'm all nervous. But this place, it's amazing. This is one of the first garage sales of the season, and it was overrun. Like, there were pickup trucks and just cars everywhere, like, parked on people's lawns. It was absurd. And this is, like, a nice neighborhood, right? And it was just nuts. And so I go in, and I'm not expecting much, especially because I see, like, you know, the usual kind of garbage at a yard sale. But there was this one table, and there was like an old Genesis, a Nintendo, and a Dreamcast all sitting there. Yeah, like with a stack of games. And there was this nice old lady selling it. If she ever listens to this, which she won't, she'll feel bad. She really wasn't that old. She was probably 50 or something. And she was saying, well, my son's on the Xbox 360 now, so, you know, whatever. Okay. And these, there were really high prices on most of these consoles. But she basically was like, you know, I just want to get rid of them. So do whatever. Take what you want. So I if anyone's been reading The Preserve regularly, they've seen my kind of quest for the black box games. And Uncle, if we talked about the black box Nintendo games very much?
I don't think we actually talked about it on one of our casts.
Yeah.
So I think it would be an excellent opportunity to discuss what they are.
I agree. Well, just, you know, in brief, the black box Nintendo games is what's kind of nowadays become the way to refer to the first season, basically, of Nintendo's releases. And I think maybe spilling over a little bit into the second year. So the first year, and I think that was 1985, basically, is when the game started coming out. And there were about 25 titles released. And these are titles like Hogan's Alley, Gumshoe. Actually, Gumshoe might have been 86. Duck Hunt, Mario Brothers, golf, baseball, pinball, 10-yard fight, and then really, really obscure titles like Stack Up. And Stack Up, I looked on eBay, and here's a little preview of an eBay watch, is going for like $500 on eBay right now. Unbelievable.
Now, is this a mint and sealed box?
No.
Sample?
No, not at all. This is a complete example, but it's just, you know, hanging out. The cartridge goes for like $100. Just the cartridge. But the
now, why does I step... The game is called Stack Up? I've never even heard of it.
I know. I had heard of it when I was a kid because I was lucky enough to get the deluxe set that came with Rob the Robot.
Oh, this was the game that you needed the Rob the Robot?
Yeah, one of the very few games that needed Rob the Robot. And like there was Gyromite. And I have Gyromite. And of course, Gyromite has like, you know, it's, you know, kind of rare, I guess, but it, and no value compared at all to Stack Up. And I don't know what's up with Stack Up, except that it came in like a double thickness box. It was like a black box, same design, the same like pixelated picture and the same just black background with a big bold block lettering on the spine. But it was double width and it had all these pieces and parts and discs and little stands and all this crap for Rob the Robot to grab onto. So like,
additional peripheral.
Yeah, so the fact that it came with all that stuff, you know, that raises the stakes, like right through the roof.
Literally.
So, yeah, so finding an example with all those
very
parts.
Very easily
yeah,
like, lose and or break them.
Yeah, like what kid is going to hang on to all seven, like, gaily colored discs that this freaking thing came with, you know? Like, and probably it was expensive. I don't have a target on what it actually cost originally, but, you know, given how expensive games were, I guarantee it was even more because it had all those parts, and that's really, you know, going to narrow the market tremendously.
Look, Charlie, just as a quick brief aside, I'm so glad that you went into this discussion of the Black Box NES.
Ah, indeed.
Because when you had originally said it, I said, oh, what a delightful opportunity to discuss Tengen and its, of course, own black for the NES Entertainment System that was used so they didn't have to pay royalties to Nintendo.
Fantastic.
But of course, that's completely wrong.
Well, that's all right. It's a good thing that you brought it up then. So I'm on a very foolish quest now to find these Black Box games. And because I have a bunch of them, a bunch being like six, you know, like Hogan's Alley, Duck Hunt, Mario, Excite Bike, a couple others. And of course, there's a bunch more, and some of them are prohibitively expensive. Even things
Charlie,
like. Yeah.
I think this really highlights or underscores the difference between you and me. Like, I'm all about having one copy of something.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the different variants and Black Box versus Silver Box versus Value Choice versus Pack-In, I have Duck Hunt, one copy, and it still works.
Yeah.
And it's fun. I have Duck Hunt. I see no need to go after all the insanely rare variants.
That's true. It's like in the Master System collection, there are the double carts with Safari Hunt and Astro Warrior. And I think Hang On and Safari Hunt, I believe it is. And Astro Warrior by itself is actually a pretty difficult cartridge to get, especially complete. But it's one of the ones I'm missing, and it's going to have to be gotten eventually. But yeah, certainly I've got the game, and it's just kind of sad because you got to get that, you got to tick that box off on the checklist, you know?
But I think it very nicely just serves as a wonderful example, a little bit of insight into the OCD mentality.
Huh.
Of a collector in anything.
I agree. Because really, my urges in this department are really replicated by many people in other, you know, kind of fanatical disciplines of varying degrees, you know, be it classic cars or stamps or coins, you know. It's really kind of something that plays itself out over again, and it's just kind of the depth of the pocket is what changes. Like the classic car guy's got the really deep pockets, things like that. So you know, I go into this sale, and I really don't know what to expect, but I got myself all jazzed up for it, because here was a garage. I haven't really actually been to a yard sale in a couple years, and because eBay's gotten so out of hand, I like to think that, you know, kind of being really diligent about the little local sales is really the only way you're ever going to score some bargains these days. And
right.
The fact that this one even advertised that it had, you know, video game equipment instead of just like a wing and a prayer, let me go sift through like another, my 15th sale of baby clothes and hope I find a Nintendo game that wasn't teethed on, you know, oh, that'll be great.
Right.
But
right. Maybe through the reams and reams of old romance novels, you'll hit upon a gem.
That's right. Man, there were those there too. But, you know, so I roll up and hear all these systems and, you know, they've got like $35 price tags on them and whatnot. But then, lo and behold, there's actually like a stack of Nintendo games, and there's some Black Box games there. I was amazed. And granted, right up front, they were kind of the more common ones, but there were common ones I didn't have. Like, there was baseball, there was golf, and there was 10-yard fight, I believe. And the boxes were pristine, which is really surprising, because this kid had them, obviously, since like 1985, 86, and clearly took really good care of his stuff, or, you know, his parents did, or whatever. But they were gorgeous and really in great shape. So, and they were $2 each. I snapped those up. And there was a Zelda in box, just sitting there in its golden glory. I'm like, all right, $2, here you go. And there was, I don't even remember what title it was, Genesis. Sega Genesis sports games are like the in-joke of video game collecting, you know? Because they're like so many of them, they have no value. There's hundreds of the things, and they have zero value, really. Well, okay, you know, within reason. But there was one there, it was, and Sega, oddly enough, for the Genesis, kind of did a Black Box thing of their own, where the original couple seasons are all in that black box with the gray grid, and then but then they changed it like in their third year, and they were really garish, like with a big red spine that said Genesis and stuff. But I always kind of like the original packaging. It's neat, and it also highlights the fact that it's an early game. So if you buy one in the black box, you just know without even looking at a checklist
that it's one of the first or first couple of years.
So they had an early sports game there. It was $2, and I opened it up, and I had one of the catalog posters, and the posters are pretty hot anyway. And like, well, hell, you know, you couldn't get the poster for $2, so you know, I'll get that. I was amazed to look at the original price tag from KB on this thing, $65, right, for this baseball game. And it's interesting, 20 years later, that you go and you see Gears of War at EB, and it's like $60, right?
The prices have remained.
Yeah, and Gears of War seems really expensive at $60, you know? It's like, man, this must be a really important game. Look at that price. And because really, you know, usually what? It's like $50, $55, and when a $60 title, now, you know, the Xbox 360 is kind of pushing these $60 titles.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's fascinating because, you know, we've all kind of forgotten when you see these old games, like, holy cow, 20 years ago, they were even more than that for, like, for, you know, what is basically this year's sports title. You know, it's because...
We're also not looking at the... Not taking into consideration inflation.
Right, exactly. So there's certainly been inflation since then. I mean, you know, 20 years worth. Absolutely a good point. So if you want to factor in inflation, Uncle, they've actually gotten significantly cheaper, it seems.
Right. Yeah, no, well, it's just remarkable that even with inflation, the prices have remained... You know, the business model... It was originally set by the NES has remained the same.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, the exception you can point to is to say that the systems themselves have gotten much more expensive, and point to the PS3 being $600.
Yeah.
By the same, I mean, we live in a video game age right now.
Yeah.
The amount of power and serious hardware that you get for the is really not that bad.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, like, but, you know, Game Informer, which is, like, the membership magazine for GameStop or whatever that I get.
Oh, yeah, I get that, too. My brother has that.
Yeah, did you see, like, 3 or 4 months ago, they had, like, a Consoles Through the Ages article that was really interesting because they talked about everything from, like, the ColecoVision, the Intellivision, Atari 2600, and they adjusted the sale prices of those systems to present-day dollars.
And I think I read that.
Yeah, I need to find that article again because it was really interesting. Like, the Intellivision, I think it was crazy expensive. It was like $600 in today's dollars. I was amazed.
For the freaking Intellivision.
That's right. Now, can you imagine what the Intellivoice add-on voice unit cost? Jesus, I didn't even see the stats for that. I have one. I think it has a price tag on it. I can go look that up. But, like... Yeah, so I go, I see these systems, they have, you know, Zelda, 3 black box games, Double Dribble in the original box, and this Sega game, and then a couple loose cartridges. I picked up Mario Brothers 2, Tetris, Dragon Warrior, and Donkey Kong Classics, which is Donkey Kong and Donkey Kong Jr. on one Nintendo cartridge. Got all that stuff, and I decided to pick up the Nintendo she had, and it has these awesome, like, Mario and Luigi stickers all over it, like, carefully placed all, like, around the door and everything. First I looked at it, I thought it was kind of hokey, but then I was like, this is actually kind of cool, because my wife's sister, Helen's sister, actually told me around Christmas last year, or around New Year's, that she really wants Duck Hunt. She wants to be able to play Duck Hunt again. So my plan for her this year is to get her an original Nintendo with a Zapper and Duck Hunt. And so I'm sitting there like, well, hold on, here's original Nintendo. I can pick it up for not much money because, you know, I made a deal. And, you know, there's the Christmas present. Now I've got to go find a Zapper and Duck Hunt, which will probably be equivalent to what I spent just getting the system. But it's kind of nice to stumble upon that and to have a use for it, you know?
Now, you see, again, listeners to our podcast, which, of course, you know, I'd just like to give a shout-out to all of you and say, thank you so much for joining in with us.
Absolutely.
Really know Charlie the way I know him. Now, I have seen portions of Charlie's collection and witnessed firsthand the sickness, as I like to call it. I would estimate that Charlie has anywhere between 7 to 10 original Nintendo Entertainment systems.
it's probably about that number. Yeah.
So, again, I don't know why any man need that many Nintendo Entertainment systems, but, you know, cool Mario and Luigi stickers, and he just bought himself another one.
But at least I plan to give this one away. And you know, I think this ties in a little bit to the car guy stuff that we were talking about earlier. And my answer to your interrogative there would be spare parts. Because you know, it's just always nice to have a spare. Just like the car guys.
And if that spare is 7 to 9, why not?
Yeah, well, you know, lots of spare parts.
And again, I just would like to say I've met both of Helen's sisters. They're both very nice. Give them one of your Nintendos and keep the one with the cool Mario stickers.
Ah, that's a good point. Well, I'll have to think about that. I probably would have to put a new pin connector in this one. I haven't tested it, but it feels pretty sloppy. So it might need a little love. A little fixing of that pin connector. But, you know, I cleaned all this stuff up, like obsessively right after the sale in a strange move of, you know, actually careful attention to immediate purchases. And everything cleaned up nice, beautiful. Even the Nintendo was all dingy, but it shined up perfectly. So
Yeah. Definitely
a good time at the yard sale. We'll have to keep an eye out for those as the summer progresses and really see what happens.
So again, in conclusion, whoever this individual was, you did an excellent job maintaining your classic games.
That's right.
And both myself and Charlie, we salute you for offering them at reasonable prices.
That's absolutely true. Absolutely true.
Now, very similar to how Charlie, through painstaking obsessiveness and work and cleaning to bring these once gems of the collection that had now just fallen into obscurity into some closet, so does Dr. Herbert West, the reanimator, reanimate things from the grave.
Oh man, isn't that the truth? We watched the reanimator the other day, and it was, anybody who hasn't seen the reanimator, just please do yourself a favor, go find it. It is a fantastic old horror movie based on a set of Lovecraft short stories, which amusingly Lovecraft didn't even actually want to write. I think Lovecraft was in need of some money at the time, and wrote these serials in some sort of like in a magazine, I forget which one, at the behest of his benefactors, and just kind of wrote them to be this schlock horror using all the kind of contrivances. And it has become a real popular thing, and the people who made the movie really did it in the spirit of his kind of not really taking it seriously. I hear that the commentary track on the DVD is really really not to be missed, where they got a lot of the original people who participated in the film to do the commentary track. And, you know, Wikipedia, be it a good thing or a bad thing, I'm really not sure if it's actually right or wrong 90% of the time. But they discuss the fact that, of course, there were two other Reanimator movies. There was an original trilogy, which I've only seen the first one. But the original, the creator of these films has long been wanting to make a fourth addition to this this trilogy. And I'm going to read you a little quote here that Stuart Gordon has been quoted on several occasions as expressing to make a fourth installment in the series entitled House of Reanimator. This film would, he claims, be a political satire wherein West moves into the White House and reanimates the deceased vice president.
Now,
you know, and that's great. Like, you know, talk about pie in the sky. Wouldn't that be awesome?
One can only dream. And, you know, I'm picturing in my mind, hopefully maybe some influence from Stephen Colbert or Jon Stewart, or just, you know, maybe the writing staff of The Daily Show or The Colbert Report.
Genius. That is fantastic. I really hope somebody thinks of that. Because the article goes on to say, in May of 2006, producer Brian Yunza told Fangoria magazine that the film was indeed being made. Indeed, Yunza expressed his desire for a large budget in order to hire well-known supporting actors, such as William H. Macy, apparently, for the film. And in addition to The House of Reanimator, he hopes to film two additional sequels in order to form a second trilogy. Now, that really is the kind of thinking I like to see.
Now, speaking of Fangoria,
yeah,
on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, from June 29th to July 1st in 2007.
Which is sadly exactly when BotCon is happening.
The precise weekend that Charlie and myself will be going to BotCon is Fangoria's Weekend of Horrors, which takes place in the Crown Plaza Meadowlands.
In Secaucus, New Jersey, I believe.
Yes, in Secaucus, New Jersey. And I'd be remiss to not let our listeners know that the man himself, Mr. Jeffrey Combs, who played the Reanimator, is going to be one of the special guests.
Oh.
Along with such luminaries as Clive Barker.
Oh.
Dee Snider.
Wonderful.
Kamal Ahmed, who is Kamal from the Jerky Boys.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, everyone's favorite, Uwe Boll.
Oh, man. So.
Oh, and Joe Bob Briggs.
Oh, fantastic. So talk about like a real, I mean, it's not really a choice because we've already got our itinerary, but it's like, man, same weekend, what a ball buster. Like, what a great event that would be.
Precisely. I mean, an opportunity to meet Uwe Boll, the man behind such unintentionally hilarious films as Alone in the Dark and Blood Rain. my opportunity to get him to sign my DVD.
Yeah.
Like, it's heartbreaking.
It really is. It really is. So now, while I'm sure that, you know, if we really work hard at it, we'll have another opportunity to at least meet some of these people, I would just encourage any of our listeners, you know, if you're not going to BotCon for whatever reason, you know, not your thing, or you can't make it up north that far, or just, you know, you happen to want to go to this horror convention, please go. You know, feel free to write into the show, let us know what it was like.
Just, oh, yes, please, send us an email.
Absolutely.
And we would love to hear your reactions to it.
Yeah, because, you know, just watch some Reanimator first, and it'll be a great time. It'll really be fantastic. So now, Uncle, I think it's about time to take a quick intermission.
Okay.
All right, and we'll be right back, folks.
Okay.
Here at the Preserve, we have recently been fortunate enough to come into the possession of one of the very limited, only 3,000 hand-numbered copies of the original Reanimator, the Definitive Edition CD score by Richard Band. So we now have this score, and we're going to feature a few selections from it for our intermission today. And in between those selections, you get to hear a little interview with the composer of this score himself, Richard Band, discussing the movie and his interaction with the directors and the cast. It is a little on the long side, so freshen your drink, get comfortable, and here we go.
Reanimator originally was being produced and directed by Brian Usna and Stuart Gordon, the director. And at that time, I believe that was during the Empire days, Empire was acting solely as a distributor for that film. Both Brian and Stuart had heard a bunch of my music from the past, and I had, needless to say, done a variety of genre films. And so we started talking about doing that film as well. When I first saw this film, well, how can I put this? I was hysterical. I was laughing so hard. I mean, this film for me was so over the top. It was funny. It was so over the top. And upon looking at this, my first gut reaction was that they, and this was, I guess, a little nervy on my part, but they had possibly not been seeing what was ending up on film as opposed to maybe what was in the script. What was ending up on film was something that was so over the top that had it been treated seriously as they first wanted it to be treated, that people would get up and walk out after 5 minutes. So I started arguing for the opportunity to score this in a campy way. This was something that in the beginning they were just dead set against. They said, no, this should be a real straight ahead horror film and so forth. Anyway, it took them another two and a half months to finish editing the film. And during those 2.5 months, we would have nothing but arguments over the direction of the film. I stuck to my guns, and slowly, I believe, Brian started seeing that perhaps I might be right. And I think Stewart finally saw that maybe I had a point, but they weren't totally sold on this idea of treating it in a campy fashion. The intention, one, was, the way I was looking at it, was what was the quintessential horror score in history? In my opinion, it was Psycho. In most people's opinion, it was Psycho. So to use those, to take those motifs and put my own theme behind it, in the main title, it's got its own theme. It's not the Psycho theme. But the orchestration and some and a couple of the motifs are definitely derived from Psycho. There's no question. That was not something I was trying to hide. It was just the opposite. I wanted to make it so obvious that everybody would go, "Wow, what is this?" And if it's that obvious, right? Then right off the bat, they know that something is twisted. I mean, nobody's going to take that and make it that obvious unless there's a reason for it. So by taking those motifs, the ones that, you know, from the real cycle, and changing them around, but still having them recognizable, then putting in my own theme, and putting in things like a drum beat, which would have never have been done, to sort of hippify it in a way, but make it even quirkier. That is what I was called. That's what I mean by, you know, twisting it around, and also again changing some of the orchestration to be more intimate and quirky. Like I use in the whole score, I use some like solo violins or solo cello or solo instruments, which makes it more intimate, and it also makes it sound quirkier in a lot of spots. So that's one way that I twisted it. The only real controversy was the Bernard Herrmann Society or something. I mean, first of all, let's get clear. I was never sued. I was never threatened to be sued. 99% of the people who saw this movie and reviewed the music got the joke. So we're only talking about a few absolute diehard people, you know, who probably, you know, pray to Bernard Herrmann several times a day, you know, east, west, or whatever, that were very upset, and they called it an abortion, which I totally agreed with, by the way. I mean, it was a total abortion. I mean, wasn't that the point, you know? So that was really the controversy, is that the Bernard Herrmann Society, which is basically a fan club of sorts, you know, said that this, you know, how could they take this, you know, most brilliant piece of music and history by one of the most brilliant composers and do this to it? I don't know. I'd say get a sense of humor, you know, that's all it was. I had insisted on the end titles to credit Bernard Herrmann, you know, for the intentional borrowing of the motifs and themes. And I mean, you might remember this. I forgot the wording, but it was something like my deepest thanks and regrets and sympathies to Bernard Herrmann for the use of his themes or whatever. It was something of the sort, but it was always my intent to do that. And but you know, filmmaking, somebody left it out of the end title credits, and that only furthered the controversy. And of course, this was not a big budget movie, so when I saw that, I said, we got to reshoot the credits. It's got to be in. I did feel very strongly about it, and I was given the option to pay for it. I didn't have the money to pay several thousand dollars for them to reshoot the end credits. we recorded this in Rome, Italy, with the Rome Philharmonic. There are various elements of the score that are quite jazz-like, in fact. And it was very difficult for the Italians to perform those elements of the score. The whole score is an orchestral score with almost no electronics. After the fact, I put in a couple of drum things that are in the main title and a couple of the motifs. I added a couple little synth things here and there, but it's 99% orchestral. And with the strings, needless to say, the most famous part of the Psycho score were the strings. It's 99% strings. I decided to not emulate that, but to veer off of it and use strings in a much smaller sense. Again, to make this a much more intimate type of score. My feeling is that the orchestration, and to make it more intimate, added to the quirkiness. If you look at the characters of Herbert West, you look at the whole way that this miskatonic university medical school is put together. It's like there's six people in the whole school or something, you know. Everything's small, everything's off-center. You know, so you can't exactly have like a big orchestral type thing. But you want weird stuff, and so I used strings in a smaller way to exemplify what was on screen. And by using strings in a smaller orchestrational sense, my belief is that adds, and also along with solo instruments and so forth, my belief is that adds to the quirkiness, along with adding like a drum beat or adding some woodwind type things. Not to mention the fact, again, that there are certain jazz elements, which is what made it problematic to record in Italy. They're used to doing westerns and epic movies, not really jazz. But there are elements in which I use a lot of these jazz motifs in a very rapid way. And for the whole orchestra to be doing that in counterpoint, which is what it is in the mayhem scenes, it very weird, very quirky, and that works. Keep in mind that whole quirkiness and that whole thematic part was very reflective in the main title, which was really a very gorgeous main title. That main title was done way after the music. So they use the music as the inspiration for a lot of these very sort of quirky, strange moves in the main title. And needless to say, again, those moves, the quirkiness, when mayhem starts happening and these bodies become reanimated, what are their motions? Their motions are like, you know, whoa, getting back alive, you know, all this, you know, jerky, weird stuff, right? So if you use solo instruments along, you know, with sectional, but if you use it in that way, and you have a violin going, you see, it sort of starts coming together. So that's why I use solo violin, some small string section stuff, and then I mix in winds and other things with it. There is the other lullaby-ish theme, which people definitely know this, which is a small reverse lifting of a Jerry Goldsmith theme from a movie called Freud, definitely was obvious. I just reversed the order of it. Why Freud? Again, think of the joke behind it all. Here you got Herbert West. He's like the Freud, or the insane doctor, right? He's the Sigmund Freud, at least in his own mind, of what this whole thing is about. Right, so that's, again, these are musical jokes that most people get. And I just sort of reversed the theme, but kept the intent there. Ideally, you can sort of balance out nice things, your nice themes or what have you, or nice orchestrations or whatever. It's nice to introduce those when you can, because it only makes the other stuff, you know, more impressive. Or it makes it work better if you're banging away all the time at at scary stuff or dissonant stuff or loud stuff, your ears, you're going to get tired of it. So it's nice to have the opportunity for the hills and valleys. Dramatically, it's nice. Oh, absolutely, Stewart's Twisted. There's no question. Why do we click? I think it was first or second time that we ever got together that we both found out from one another that we both love Frank Zappa music, and we would sit and have barbecues and dinner and stuff, and we would sing entire Frank Zappa albums from the past. So anybody who loves Zappa that much and could sing an entire album with me has got to be twisted. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that part. So we clicked on that level. He is twisted. He's got a great sense of humor. And, you know, and you're right. It was the first of I guess, about five movies or six movies or something like that. He's got a twisted sense of humor. He's twisted in a lot of ways, and I find it humorous. I find it entertaining, and I find it very challenging. On other films that we worked on, I guess the thing that I like about Stewart is he always gives me the latitude to do something different, And a lot of the time, he really insists upon it. So we'll sit sometimes and go back and forth creatively on a direction or a way to do something different. And that's fun because, especially in certain genre things, I mean, genre has been done to death in so many different ways. You know, why would I want to do it at all anymore unless I had the opportunity to do something different with it? And Stewart has given me those opportunities. The thing I guess I'm proudest about when it comes to Reanimator itself is we all took some risks on there, some big risks. And it, if anything, it's a good thing in the long run to know that occasionally when you do take risks that they pay off in the long run. And I think from a creative standpoint, I think it's paid off. I think it's paid off for Stewart. I think it's paid off for me. I think it's paid off for Brian, for a lot of people involved in the film. It was risky. And I think it did change the way some people, you know, approach filmmaking in the genre and in the funny horror way and all that, and I think it's fun, and I'm proud of that part of it. We'll be right back.
And we're back. I hope everybody enjoyed that as much as we did. And I thought maybe we could discuss Walmart for a few seconds, mainly because they've really done an interesting job. And it's, of course, because they're such a gargantuan seller of all the products that our capitalistic society needs to thrive and continue in its merry way, of getting their own customized or their own branded or their own limited edition items. And certainly Transformers are no exception to this cavalcade. And I think that the uncle could maybe inform us a little bit about the latest addition to the Transformers suite of Walmart exclusives.
Okay, so a couple of years ago, back when the Transformers Energon line came out, I wasn't too into Transformers, chiefly because the main gimmick, which most of the Autobots featured, was something called power linking, which while on paper sounds cool, the reality of the fact was that they had to make robots that not only transformed from a vehicle to a robot, but could also, quote-unquote, power link to combine with other robots.
Oh, I remember that. Okay, yeah.
So again, already you have to make certain concessions to get a robot to look like a race car. When you also have to design and figure a way for it to meet with a series of other toys, it just, I don't know.
It just compromised. Too many compromises there, right?
Exactly, too many compromises, and I thought the toys really looked not that great. And I really bought, I think I only have one Energon figure in my entire collection.
Yeah, I think
I'm... The reason I have it is because he's a non-power-linking figure, and he looks very cool. And I got him at the Dollar General.
Oh, yeah, right.
Okay, so anyway, towards the very tail end of the line, what they started to do was they came out with Gestalts. Which, of course, if you're a Transformers fan, is slang for a combiner.
Yep.
What the German word for imitation has to do with a team of five green and purple construction equipment to turn into a giant robot, I don't know. But anyway, one of the final Energon figures was Devastator, which, of course, is the, at least in Generation 1, was the six-component construction vehicles that all formed together to form a robot.
And six components being interesting, because, of course, they didn't even carry that theme forward, but it was the real first, the real progenitor.
Right. And, of course, also another just a quick tidbit, the original Devastator, originally, when he was in Diaclone, which was the Japanese line that many of the Transformers molds were taken through, I don't know what his name was. I think it was Viltron or something along those lines, but he was a good guy.
Oh, right. Was he colored orange at that point or something like that?
Yes, yeah. He had they were all colored different. There was like an orange one, a red one, a green one.
Yeah.
And when he got imported over, they turned him, of course, to Decepticon Devastator, and they got their very iconic lime green and purple windshield deco. But anyway, right. I digress, though.
Quite all right.
This Energon combiner, when it came out, had one main body limb, meaning, which basically, if you're familiar with Voltron, the Black Lion component. And then what they did was, I thought was rather unfortunate, the two limbs for the arms were the same mold, which is painted.
Oh, yeah, that's always a bummer.
And the two legs were also the same mold painted differently.
You know I hate those repaints, man.
And I do as well. I mean, if you're going to even go and do a combiner, do it right. Make five unique molds. But I guess, you know, to keep the cost down and
right.
Keep your mileage out of the molds and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I actually wanted to get this, you know, I'm a fan of Devastator, I wanted to get the thing, but it was done, it released in such a way that some of the limbs were just impossible to get, and I never saw all five limbs at once at the store because they were in different waves, which is the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life, because...
You know, just to interject here, this is funny, because I think that five of the only Energon figures I have are actually all the Devastator figures. And and I believe I've got it assembled in a display case somewhere, but it highlights so little that Energon actually made an impression on me that I've totally forgotten that. But I believe I actually scrounged out all the Devastator parts at a Walmart someday, like a couple years ago, a year and a half ago.
Also, just as an aside, the other two combiners were, of course, Superion, who's made up of five jets, but of course it's only three unique molds.
Ah, right.
And Bruticus.
Right.
Again, in this scenario, unfortunately, only had three molds.
Oh, they did that for all of them. Okay.
I am of the mind that if they wanted to do it, they should have done it right. Instead of offering us all three, they should have maybe axed one of them and had only two, maybe Superion and Devastator, not even Bruticus. given them five individual limbs.
And that's true, because they went to the trouble to make, you know, they would have had enough if they had just done two.
Right. I mean, I think so. But then again, I don't work in the industry. I'm just...
Yeah. That bottom line, you know. But so that was then, this is now, and now we're in this kind of brave new world of better figures.
Right, yes. And, of course, Walmart, as you know, is like one of the largest retailer in the world, and they wanted a Classics exclusive. So Hasbro gave them Devastator, and they had him, all the paint jobs were recolored from the Energon, the way they were painted in Energon, and they were packaged together as a box set. And I, of course, wanted to buy it, but because the Walmart nearby me has terrible distribution and or a large proportion of scalpers, I have never seen this in retail at all.
Well, so, I mean, because it should be out for almost a month now, right?
Oh, yeah, it's out. I mean, I've read various reports. I mean, I believe if you go to Walmart's website, it's up listed on the website, so it's not like it just came out.
Well, perhaps we should buy it from the website.
That actually might be my only recourse.
Yeah.
I mean, exclusives, they're really a double-edged sword when it comes to collectors, because while it's cool to, you know, exclusive things that other people might not have, it always stinks when, you know, the store, you don't have a location at the store
yeah.
that carries it near you.
Yeah, I mean, and they really sucked me in with this, and I think I have to blame you for getting me turned on to it, because I've really been avoiding buying the new lines, just because I've really got my hands full with classic toys now, as everybody knows, and I can't keep up too well with the new figures, just, you know, space concerns, if nothing else. But the new Classics line of Transformers, I really dug the packaging, the styling, and just, of course, you know, the fact that they restacked the logo, little things like that just make me hearken back to the 80s, and I really enjoy. And so...
It's funny, Charlie, that you brought up the packaging. I would say the Classics is the one line where the packaging actively inhibits my enjoyment.
Oh, inhibits.
Precisely. If they had done basic a re-update of the green and purple grid boxes from G1...
Ah, well, that's true.
Kind of weird, like, window boxes, trapezoids.
Yeah.
It would have been an absolute home run.
Well, certainly, I would love it even more. I guess there's something about it that I feel is different enough from what they did with Energon and Armada that I dig that packaging substantially better. But of course, my favorite still continues to be the really retro, the really old, you know, 1984, 85, 86 boxes. But I don't know what it is. I think it's the logo is pretty close to being right, you know, because it's and the colors at least are kind of the 1980s bold primary solid palette. You know, the reds, the yellows, kind of what my entire museum room looks like. Because you got the mask figures, the Starcom figures, all these bold reds and yellows, and at least that, you know, the boxes are kind of awash with that. And this exclusive set is supposed to be packaged, you know, in that, right? It's supposed to be the kind of updated Classics packaging for the Constructicons.
Yes, of course.
Nice. Well, you know, I've been dedicatedly looking for them myself, and I have to admit that I haven't been able to find them either. So this is a real issue that we're gonna have to sort out.
Another note, Charlie. Yeah. The last two alternators, Alternator Ravage and Rumble.
Ah, yes,
haven't been able to locate either one of these.
Those either. Wow.
I've heard that they're only available at Walmart.
Yeah.
Don't know if they're an exclusive or Walmart was just, you know, the primarily area where they've been spotted. If you've seen either one of these during your many toy hunts and travels and goings-on, please pick up a set for me. I will gladly reimburse
them. There you go. So I'll be getting two each when I find them.
Yes, sweet.
Fantastic.
Sweet. Thank you, Michael. And same thing, of course, with Constructicon.
Yes, indeed.
Him, pick me up a copy, and I'll gladly send you money for it.
As usual, I'll probably call you from the actual store and rant excitedly about things I see before me. And
believe me, those are the most exciting phone calls I get.
Ah, understood. And that really puts me in mind of you know, my excited ranting about Pryor's Place that everybody is familiar with recently. And I just have a couple quick updates about Pryor's Place.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, on your solid encouragement, Uncle, I managed to win that 8x10 black and white photograph of Richard Pryor that was on eBay. Yeah, and everybody who might have missed this on the preserve, it'll be showing up soon to a greater photo expose once it's in my little hands, is a wonderful picture of Richard Pryor, not even in the right costume, so it's clearly like an early publicity photo for his show, playing the saxophone at Chill's Corner, and then with a letter, like a type letter on CBS letterhead, like just saying, this is a picture from Pryor's Place, whatever, and it has little like mailing codes in the upper corner. So it's really a very strange piece that this auction house on eBay was apparently commissioned to sell a bunch of the archives from their local CBS station for whatever reason. And, you know, they pulled this out and said, yeah, whatever, here's something called Briar's Place with this letter. And so since it's my new kind of thing to be interested in this and kind of the history of it and how little you can find about it, this piece is pretty cool from a, you know, from a research and historical standpoint. Or as you like to say the other day, which I really enjoyed, Uncle, that I'm kind of like CSI for eBay, which I enjoy.
That's true. And I think this really gets to the heart of the Parry Game Preserve, and to a lesser extent, the UncleCast is all about. All about finding and rediscovering forgotten pieces of pop culture.
Absolutely, and correct.
With the explosion of the internet and the popularity of sites like Retro Junk and X Entertainment and, you know, all sorts of, and what's 80s Toy Box?
Yeah.
That it actually is becoming harder and harder and harder to bring something up that maybe a lot of people have forgotten.
That's right.
It really hasn't remained in the current pop culture pantheon, or whatever you would call it.
Yeah.
And so that's why I think this is such a huge victory for you and myself and, you know, all fans of, as I like to call it, pop culture deteriorous from years gone by.
Very good. And I entirely agree. That really distills kind of my aims and my where I really get the most enjoyment, when I can somehow find these things that are still under the radar and really kind of show everybody how cool they were. And I take my kind of selfish delight if at least nobody else has found them already and kind of beaten them to death. If I can find these little things that are forgotten about, then I really think we all win. It's really fantastic. That's,
everyone wins.
That's
and,
right.
And you hear that, Sean, baby? Sound of inevitability.
That's right. And so, you know, that I suppose that's pretty much my eBay watch, other than just saying, in brief, it seems that the prices of Captain Power figures are back on the rise. Oddly enough, carded Captain Power figures, mint on card, were dirt cheap for ages, and now they're actually starting to get some reputable value behind them, which is interesting. No idea
Charlie,
why.
It's actually very interesting that you mentioned that. I've heard unsubstantiated in a line from, I think it was Toy Fair, which is a wonderful magazine published by the same people that publish Wizard, only it's all about toys, that actually Captain Power is coming back to official DVD.
No.
So maybe, you know, that is, you know, the rumblings went out.
Interesting.
And we're starting to see the very beginning.
Wow. Well, I'll tell you what, that means we need to get those DVDs from Randy soon, because he has a lot of really interesting exclusive content, like the Captain Power music video, original commercials, all this weird stuff.
Which probably will not make it onto the official.
Right. But what it does mean is that when that official DVD comes out, his DVD becomes immediately illegal, and he won't be able to sell it any longer.
It will not be able to legally sell it.
Yeah, whereas now, you know, honestly, he can legally sell it, because it is not possible to get those episodes from any actual, you know, established channel.
And speaking of Randy, would you happen to know his website? Maybe we could give him a nice plug.
Well, you know, I think that if you go to CaptainPower.com, the Captain Power enthusiasts, including Randy and Janice, maintain that site, and that you can actually find links there to purchase his DVD. It's a double box set, like a two-volume box set. He's done a really fabulous job. It's totally remiss that the uncle and I have not picked up this set yet, but it...
We got to jump on this.
Like fans from across the world, really, and because really, people are widely distributed, and you get to hear from all of them when it's such a small thing like Captain Power fandom. You know, France, Turkey, China, Japan, Russia have all gotten their sets and say they're really fantastic. The only problem people have experienced is when the post office throws them out of a plane. So, you know, basically he's done a great job on these things, and I recommend everybody check him out. I can only recommend that from, you know, hearsay, and we should really recommend it from experience very soon. And this is interesting news you bring to us, Uncle, that maybe oddly enough, Captain Power is about to have its moment in the spotlight.
That's right. It is coming. Apparently, it's coming back.
Yeah, well, that helps explain why there was a neat auction recently. And, you know, there were like 10, 11 figures, and it went for a sizable amount of money. And it just shows that maybe they're getting popular again. So I think that, you know, that's pretty much the eBay watch. I would encourage everybody to just keep an eye on the preserve. And I think that, Uncle, that pretty much wraps us up for today.
I think that does it.
Fantastic. Well, look, everybody, it's been excellent having you here with us. Get ready for the next UncleCast, and remember, we're zeroing in on BotCon, which is just going to be a fantastic time for everybody.
That's right.
All right. Well, everyone, have a great week.
Have a great week, Charlie.
Yeah, thank you very much. And we'll, you know, you and I will gather some more absurdity for the folks at home over the next 7 to 14 days.
Excellent.
All right, everybody. Later, Uncle.
Bye.
Bye.